I got an interesting email from a student. I'll just read it to you and then share some thoughts on it. You discussed quite extensively that when people are in the workforce, they are all losing quite a bit of their negative freedom because of the typical hierarchy in the workplace. Essentially, in simple terms, they are being dictated by a force, their manager or supervisor. Therefore, because of this relationship, they have lost some of their freedom from telling, because someone else is telling them what to do. My question in regards to this is, what happens if you are a manager, the boss, or a business owner? Are you gaining back some of your negative freedom? Or are you still losing your negative freedom because, for example, if you are the business owner, you are in a sense working to please your customers in order to gain more profits? So I thought there were some really interesting points there. Let me just clarify. So let me start at the end of the question that was raised. If it's true, if you're a business owner, you're trying to sell things to customers, and the customers have some power because they can always say, I don't want to buy it. And so you have to think, well, what can I do to get them to buy my stuff, to buy my service, my goods? And you are, in a sense, therefore, accommodating your behavior to their preferences. And that looks a little bit like your consumers are kind of controlling you. And after all, that is what economists like to think when they talk about consumer sovereignty. That is, that consumers are telling business owners what to do. But they're telling them what to do in a very different sense from a boss telling a worker what to do. They're not ordering them what to do. They are informing them of what their preferences are. And the owner of a business is then responding. It's much more like a negotiation than it is like an authority relation. Now, managers in businesses do have a kind of power over other people. They do tell workers what to do. But managers also can be fired by the employer. So managers are in what you might think of as a kind of contradictory position with respect to this issue of negative freedom. They have more autonomy than your average worker. They do have more control over what they do and how they do it. But they're still subject to the authority of people above them in a hierarchy. And so they're in this kind of complicated double position. And many of the stresses of being a manager come precisely from that. They're caught between top and bottom. They are given orders, and that is the sense in which they have less negative freedom. They have to follow orders given by someone else, but they also give orders. It's an example of something which we'll be talking about a little bit later when we talk about social class, about how some positions don't kind of neatly fall into a position of either being in control or being controlled. They're kind of both. And that's a particular kind of complexity. All right. Let's finish up the material from the last lecture. Just to locate our whole discussion, we began with the virtues of the market, what it's supposed to do. We've spent the last two lectures talking about why, in spite of those virtues, there are indeed problems, that the environment, markets have problems. And we've spent the last two lectures discussing a whole range of problems, especially problems centered around inefficiencies, ways in which markets create inefficiencies in the world rather than markets solve problems. They create problems. The last set of issues around the consequences of markets that I wanted to talk about, and which I'll briefly do so at the beginning of this lecture, are the consequences of markets for non-market social interactions, how markets affect important kinds of social values. And I began and just very quickly stated at the end of the last lecture a kind of fundamental sociological idea that doesn't just relate to markets, it relates to all aspects of social life, that institutions shape values. And markets shape values and personality and character in very specific ways. This is not a special feature of markets. It's a general feature of all social institutions, that they shape the kinds of people we have. Some people like to think that there's some invariant thing called human nature, and that our human nature is to be selfish and competitive. Now, the way I would put it is that it is in our human nature to be selfish and competitive, but that is not all that constitutes our nature. We are also generous and kind. And what the balance in our lives and in our character and in our values between the urge to be better than everybody else and the urge for everybody to do well, those are two different kinds of impulses, two different kinds of motivations. I want to be better than everybody else. I want everybody to do well. The balance between those, that balance is not given by nature. As a particular kind of animal, we have the capacity for both of these, generosity and selfishness. But how they get put together, both across individuals, you know, there's a couple hundred people in the class, there's a different balance between these two motivations, preferences, or values across individual people, but also across time and place. Different societies have different balances. Well, how that balance is forged depends a lot upon the nature of the institutions in which we live. Even in a very strongly market-centered economy like ours, where the virtues of competition and individual success are trumpeted all the time, even in this hyper-competitive jungle of market capitalism in which we live, people are generous and cooperative in spite of this market culture. So I'm not saying that because markets are so important, it obliterates these other motives. It just reduces their weight in social life and tends to devalue them relative to other kinds of virtues. And that's the general idea that you really should try to take from this part of the analysis and think about for all sorts of other contexts. The kinds of people we get in a society is not given by nature, but by the ways our institutions encourage some traits and discourage others. So that's the general point. Now we want to look at how this actually works in markets. Oh, well, I guess I already had number one. So the first thing I'd like to say about markets with respect to this is that markets have a tendency to undermine a sense of solidarity and community. Markets tend to undercut a sense that we're all in this together and that a central part of our life should be devoted towards collectively solving problems and cooperating to make improvements, as opposed to simply individually striving to be better and to succeed at other people's expense. Free riding is an example of this. Free riding is a general problem of cooperation. People want to free ride on the sacrifices of others. Free riding is reduced when people hold altruistic preferences. But altruistic preferences, that is your preference to cooperate because it's for the good of all, altruistic preferences depend upon a sense of solidarity with others, a sense of community. And the competitiveness of markets and the emphasis on individualistic self-interest undermines such a sense of solidarity and weakens the values that we think of as associated with community. The market cultivates a sense of individual responsibility of looking out for number one. That was a kind of expression of the 1980s. But the market also cultivates mistrust. Everybody's out for their own individual advantage. Everyone's out to make a fast buck. You have to be wary. Buyers beware. Buyers beware as a slogan is basically saying you've got to be on your toes because you shouldn't be too trusting. Now, some people think that's just fine. Nice guys finish last. That's another market slogan. Life is competition. Life is shopping. These are things which we're good at, and there are people who will think this is perfectly fine. But I think many people find it expressions like nice guys finish last, which is you can see why that's a market idea, nice guys finish last. It implies you're being too kind, you're being too generous, you're not being ruthless enough. And unless you're ruthless, you finish last. Well, most people, I think, find that a little disturbing. They may accept it as a reality, they may even act on that principle, but it doesn't sit comfortably with most people. Because in our private lives, in our intimate relations, we rely very heavily on living with nice guys, with people who are generous and kind and considerate, not who are always out to get as much as they can at our expense. All of these features of markets have, and their consequences, have big spillover effects for the quality of life in general. So this doesn't just bear on the issue of the efficiency of markets, it bears on the quality of life that we have in a society. What I'm calling the value of community is very close to the core value of many religious traditions. The aphorism, love thy neighbor, is basically a value of community. That's fundamentally what it means in social terms. Love thy neighbor as thyself means don't be a free rider. Cooperate, collaborate for the common good. And so this is the first point I want to make, that where you have an unfettered, highly competitive market with high stakes, winner take all, lots of losers, great triumphant successes, when that is the way we organize how well people's lives go, it erodes these communitarian or community values. There is thus a kind of tension which, you know, in the contemporary politics is not stated very often, but there is a kind of tension between Christianity and markets. Christianity, as a religious tradition, emphasizes all sorts of values that are systematically contradicted by the way markets work, as opposed to Christianity being the kind of religion of the market. I think that's simply not an adequate way of understanding the connection between these economic practices and certain religious principles. All right, that's the first point about community. The second point has to do with what could be called the commercialization of morally salient aspects of life. The commercialization of morally salient aspects that threatens the values that those aspects of life involve. There are lots and lots of examples that one can give. I've been speaking about religion. The commercialization of religion, treating religion as something which you sell on a market, where mega churches become big commercial enterprises that generate masses of wealth for the leaders of those mega churches, the gospel of wealth, it's sometimes, you know, this becomes enshrined as actually a virtue. I think that the commercialization of religion undermines core spiritual and religious values. And I think most deeply religious people would feel that as well. They're uncomfortable with Christmas as a commercial festival rather than a religious holiday. The commercialization of religion degrades religion. But there are lots of other examples which might be a little bit less obvious. Take child care. There's many ways that child care can be provided for young children. The most celebrated way is within the family, that parents love and take care of their children. And there's something very precious about the nature of the social relation that gets formed by virtue of the people who have the strongest lifetime commitment to those particular persons, those particular children, having deep responsibility for their care. And that's why the idea that families should provide childcare has such weight in most people's understanding of what's good for children. It's because it's not even so much a kind of empirical question, is this better or worse? It's that it is a symbolic question, that it embodies the values that we care about. when we have children and take care of them. But there are many other ways you can take care of children. You can have daycare centers of all sorts. Some daycare centers can be very closely tied into a community. So it's a community of adults who are taking care of a community of children, closely connected to the parents, with lots of parental involvement, and the community center and the child care services are not so distant from what child care within a family would be like. You can also have for-profit corporations running daycare centers for children. You can treat the care of children as something in which you can maximize profits by providing a service. Well, is this a good or a bad thing? I myself feel that there's lots of ambiguities and difficulties when the care of young children is entrusted to people who are trying to maximize profits by doing so. One of the consequences of that, for example, is that for-profit daycare centers want to maximize the number of children per employee because they make more money that way. And they want to minimize what they pay the child care workers because you make more money that way. If profit maximization is the condition under which the service is provided, it seems unlikely that the quality of the service itself will reflect the true values we want in childcare, which is love, nurturance, concern for the real well-being and needs of a child, and not concerns for the bottom line of the business that's providing the service. That's why I think the evidence is generally pretty strong that community-based childcare services, which are not for profit, and which are emphasizing these other values, generally provide a higher quality of service than for-profit daycare providers. What about markets that are trying to establish the value of human life through a market? The value of human life through a market. After 9/11, there was a commission set up to provide compensation to the families of the people who died in the Twin Towers when they went down. And it was a pretty interesting social phenomenon, this problem. How do you decide what the compensation should be? Because the Twin Towers were a financial center, but it also had restaurants in it and janitors. So you had some people who earned very little and some people who earn millions of dollars a year, all working in the same building, and all killed by the terrorist attack. And the 9/11 Commission had to decide what would be the compensation. The government allocated a fair amount of money to provide compensation to the families, but it got a little bit creepy, in my judgment, when it turned out that the compensation for a rich person was way more than the compensation for a poor person. And there was this feeling that somehow their lives were worth more. And they had this particular way of thinking about it. Life is worth the lost earnings that that person would have provided. That was the worth of a life. Well, you can understand, I mean, I'm sympathetic to the commission's problem. You can understand why that was a reasonable way to approach the problem. But that represents a kind of marketization, a commercialization of a value which we really don't want to treat that way. We could go on with this. In the chapter, I discuss a bunch of other examples. It's just something I think for you to think about. This is a good, you know, lunchtime conversation with friends. What are the things which you think really, the values you care about most in them, get hurt when they're subjected to a market logic, a profit-maximizing logic? Yeah?
I think we agreed that humans have prevailed through survival of the fittest. Do you think that because this kind of market promotes that signaling needs to mean progression as a human race?
So it is, one view is that, taking Darwin quite literally, that species evolve through survival, quote, survival of the fittest, and humans did too, and therefore the kind of ruthlessness of competitive markets is actually good, because it promotes a certain kind of progress. So a couple of comments on that. First of all, the basic claim that human cultures survive because of survival of the fittest turns out, even in evolutionary biology these days, not to be adequate as an explanation. There is also a very powerful force for the evolution of cooperation in human species. Those communities, those early human communities that were able to forge strong solidarities were able to survive better than those that were more ruthlessly individualistic. So there is a natural selection for cooperation as well as for individualism. And that's because we are what are called social animals. Our survival is contingent upon the prosperity of the collective in which we live, not just our own advance. And therefore, it's as much a part of evolution that cooperation develops. It's why, in fact, human beings are not just social animals, they're moral animals. We have a capacity to feel guilt for violating moral precepts, most of which concern being kind and generous. I mean, you know, this is a way oversimplification, but an awful lot of morality is about being a decent person with respect to other people. And people feel guilty when they violate those rules, those norms. It's not just because they've been taught to feel guilty, it's because we have a guilt capacity. Our brains are wired in such a way as to generate this experience of remorse and guilt when we violate norms. Well, that's a net result of evolution, our moral capacity. And that moral capacity is as central to our survival and to our human progress as is our ability to beat out other people. Now, my position on these matters with respect to the market and respect to these big moral social questions is not that as a result of the fact that markets foster individualism and competition, we should get rid of markets. No, it's that we need to regulate markets. We need to subdue them. We shouldn't have them be the centerpiece of how we think about every problem. Markets play a role. Competition plays a role. But it needs to be combined with social practices that foster collaboration and cooperation just as much. And that the problem in American society with respect to the market is not the sheer fact of the market, but its overemphasis, its over-centrality within the overall structure of American society. There's much more to say about this. For time reasons, I will stop here. There's more in the book about it as well. Finally, the third thing I want to emphasize about markets is not so much about values, that is what our preferences are, our values, but about skills. Markets cultivate a particular kind of skill. This issue is captured by an expression, a contrast, which is sometimes used in social theory, between two ways that you deal with a problem, referred to as exit and voice. These are two ways that you deal with a problem. So what do I mean by this? Exit means if you don't like something, you quit. If you don't like your job, you quit and get another one. If you don't like a course, you drop it and enroll in another one. If you don't like the country you live in, you migrate to another. If you don't like a restaurant, you go to a different one. If you don't like your marriage, you get a divorce. Exit. You leave situations that you don't like. This is the way you deal with dissatisfaction in a market. This is the kind of shopping view of problem solving. And it's what shopping cultivates. Shopping cultivates discriminating choices between alternative products and responses to disappointment. Instead of going to the manager of a restaurant after an unsatisfactory meal and saying, look, that meal wasn't very good. Here's some suggestions about how it could be made better. And I'll come back next time and let's work on it. You know, you don't do that. That's not the way you treat the problem. If you have a roommate and they cook an unsatisfactory meal when it's their turn, you might say, come on, let's figure this out. You're not doing this job seriously. Let's work on it. That's voice. Voice is, if you don't like something, you speak up. You try to change it. You try to improve the product. If you don't like your job, you talk to the boss and your fellow workers, and you try to improve conditions. If you don't like a course, you tell the professor, there's something wrong in this course. You're being incoherent. The assignments are way too hard, or whatever. And you try to negotiate and work out a solution. If you don't like the government, you organize politically to change it. That's voice, not exit. Now here's the problem. Markets encourage a style of dealing with problems through exit. That's what markets are good at. They're good at giving you an array of choices, and if you don't like one, you pick another. Voice, it turns out, is difficult. It's a hard skill to do well. Markets cultivate the skill of exit, but not the skill of voice. And shopping is the model of getting what you want rather than community participation and deliberation. This has very broad ramifications for society. Consider the problem of schools in the United States today. Schooling in the United States is often regarded as in a crisis. Actually, the problem with schooling in the United States is how uneven it is. We have fantastic schools. I imagine many of you went to really excellent, interesting high schools and had found the educational experience very productive and rich and rewarding, and others went to mediocre high schools. It's the unevenness that's more the problem, particularly the unevenness when it gets correlated with class, rather than uniformly bad public schools. We have many, many extraordinarily good public schools. Well, what's one of the proposed solutions to the problem of uneven quality? It's to give parents choice to make schools more competitive. That's considered a solution. That's a market-like solution to the problem. Get schools to compete with each other. If you have a problem of teachers not performing well, what's the solution? Get teachers to compete with each other, as opposed to trying to figure out ways to increase the collaboration among teachers so that the best teachers can help the struggling teachers, to increase community involvement and parent involvement in schools so you have strong parent-teachers associations that are actively involved in forming school policies. That would be a voice form of solution to school quality problems, as opposed to an exit. I think myself that the problem of high divorce rates in the United States is in part a result of the strong competitive market culture we have. It's a great irony, I think, for conservatives who believe both in the sanctity of marriage and in the desirability of unregulated markets. They believe in both of these things. Whereas I think that the unregulated, free, highly competitive market cultivates a style of dealing with problems that makes it harder within intimate relations for people to exercise voice, to see as the way you deal with the difficulty, and social relations at an intimate level are always difficult. They always require work. Well, that work needs to be valued. It needs to be, and it needs to be cultivated so people are good at it. Markets don't encourage this. Okay, the main point from this is that markets foster people skillful in one kind of solution over another. And to say it really bluntly, markets undermine democratic skills because democracy depends upon voice, upon people actively engaged in organizing and voicing their views in order to shape the destiny of society. Now on to the next topic, which undoubtedly will spill over into Tuesday's lectures. The environment. We are, at the moment, somewhere between a crisis and a catastrophe with respect to the environment. There's disagreement in the scientific community as to whether the environmental problems that are accumulating in the world to do are merely a crisis or whether what looms on the horizon is really catastrophe. But there is no disagreement among scientists that we are in very serious difficulties with respect to the environment. What I want to do in this lecture is first, very quickly, just give you some basic facts about the current state of the environment, what the lay of the land is. Some of this, I think, will be familiar to many of you. I am not going to turn, this is not going to be a lecture that's mainly about the dimensions of the environmental crisis itself. I just want to use that as stage setting for the discussion. And then what I want to do is explore a variety of different explanations for the nature of our environmental problems, some of which are closely connected to the way our markets work and some of which deal with other matters. So we'll be looking at a variety of explanations. These are not alternative explanations. You don't have to pick one. These all represent causal processes in play in the world in which we live that are shaping the environment as we find it. But first, just a quick, just a quick little tour through, here I'll put the lights down on the front to make it a little clearer. A quick little tour of some basic environmental facts. This is a graph of fossil fuel consumption and reserves into the future and the projections about how consumption in the future will look with respect to these. This was as of 2007. I don't have the updated figures. It would be a little bit further over to the right on the actual. Now, there's some debate about what the shape of the reserves are in the future. People who want to minimize environmental problems tend to say there are always more reserves that get discovered. Well, it's clearly implausible that there will always be more reserves that will be discovered. At some point, there is a finite limit to the material resources of the planet. And the thing about fossil fuels is that you can't recycle them. You burn them up when they're used as fuel. So it's not like some products, which you can use over and over again. And it's not like wood, which you can grow again. These are ultimately finite supplies. And this is a one particular set of projections, not the most dire as to what the future holds. And at least by every account that I've looked at, sometime in the course of the next 20 to 30 years, we are on the downward sloping part of the curve for all of these reserves. Doesn't mean necessarily that economies will collapse, that we will no longer have fossil fuels available. It means that if we keep increasing our consumption at the present rate, we will run out. And it's not centuries into the future that we will run out. It's in the course of your lifetimes, there will be serious exhaustion of supplies with respect to these fossil fuels. This is the chart of global temperatures. You've all heard about global warming. This is the long sort of chart. The annual average is in blue. The five-year running averages are in red. Sometime in the last 50 or 60 years, the curve began to go relentlessly up. This is a graph that shows some what are called summer temperature anomalies. That is, how frequently in the summer are temperatures above the historic average or tremendously above the historic average. The red part of the curve represents the number of above historic average events. Where those are balanced, as in the period 1951 to 80 with below normal, you figure you're in a stable regime of climate. When if you're taking the 1951 to 1980 norm as your baseline, when you begin to shift more and more to the right, when the number of events that are below average declines and the number of events that are super above average increase, and if this persists, you realize that you're in a new kind of climate regime. One of the lines disappeared from my chart. There it is, okay. This is global temperatures and carbon dioxide. So the major explanation that's offered by the scientific community, and again, this is not controversial among environmental scientists and climate scientists. It is controversial politically, but that's because people have rejected science as the basis for understanding these processes, not because there's debate, serious debate among scientists on these issues. The major way that scientists explain this tendency towards global warming that we're experiencing is because of an increase of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide is a normal byproduct of all sorts of activities. When we breathe, we exhale carbon dioxide. It's a normal byproduct of all sorts of activities, but it's a particularly important byproduct of burning fossil fuels. Carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere have gone up quite systematically and dramatically in recent decades. And when the carbon dioxide increases, the heat absorbing capacity of the atmosphere increases. What this chart shows from the late 19th century to the present is how concentrations of carbon dioxide have increased and what the patterns of temperature deviations have been over the last 100 plus years. These are temperature deviations from what was the average temperature for the base period. So if you take the average temperature for the entire 20th century, these then are deviations below that average or above that average. Now, of course, as anyone should know, the mere fact that there is a coincidence in this upward slope of carbon dioxide and this massive increase in the number of above average temperatures, and in which the above average temperatures are increasingly above average, the mere correlation between these two doesn't establish causation. It requires then a proper scientific analysis of the mechanisms involved to actually establish that this is a causal relation. This is just for the United States. It's U.S. daily temperature extremes on a per decade basis, and then in recent years on an annual basis, showing the ratio between temperature extremes that are record highs and record lows. Right, so in any year there'll be some temperatures that are record highs and record lows. You want to know what the ratio is between these. So you can see that in the 1950s, there were 1.09 record highs for every record low. In the 60s, there was 0.77 highs for every record low. In the 70s, 0.78. And in the 80s, 1.14. So from the period from the 50s to the 80s, you wouldn't identify any particular trend. You get lots of record highs and lots of record lows, but they're roughly balanced out. In the 1990s, it goes up. In the 2000s, you get over two record highs for every record low. In 2012, we had 9 record highs for every 1 record low in the United States as a whole. The last picture here comes from the New York Times from yesterday. There was a headline on the online record high that the Arctic sea ice melt, which always happens in the summer, reached its lowest level ever, or highest level melt. The sea ice remaining was at its lowest level ever for the year. Based on satellite records. The melting of the sea ice is one of the iconic examples of the consequences of global warming. Well, I could go on with a lot more. I won't here. Global warming is one example of an environmental problem that is universally regarded as a problem. It's going to produce in your lifetimes enormous difficulties in the world. There will be rises in sea levels, which will have devastating effects on certain parts of the world, not on Wisconsin, but on coastal areas in parts of the world. There will be dramatic changes in rainfall. The increased temperature of the planet produces greater violent weather effects because of weather instability that's generated by this. This is going to produce huge amounts of havoc in the course of your lifetimes. The question then is, how should we understand the processes that are generating these problems? Now, I'm not going to focus specifically on global warming. I'm going to speak more generally about how do we understand the relationship between different kinds of social practices, the things we do, and the environment in which we live. And I'm going to explore 5 different kinds of explanations. Just to briefly list them first, individual lack of concern for the environment and free riding. Negative externalities, we already talked about that. That's a big theme for understanding environmental problems. The strategies of powerful actors, as opposed to simply the byproducts of people doing their own thing, the actual strategies of actors that generate environmental problems. Indirect cultural effects of hypercapitalism, a capitalist society that is in a sort of superheated form of capitalism, particularly consumerism as a source of environmental problem. And finally, the way in which ideologies that are associated with this kind of capitalism prevent solutions. This last one is a kind of interesting problem. When you think about how do you explain something, what are the causes of something, it's important to ask not just what generates the problem, but what might obstruct the solution. An example I sometimes like to give is that if you see someone walking on crutches with an amputated leg, the natural thing to ask is, why do they have an amputated leg? And there'd be all sorts of explanations for why that might have happened. But there's another question, is why don't they have a prosthesis? That is, if they had a good prosthetic leg, you wouldn't notice that they had an amputated leg, because modern prosthetic legs are such that a person walking down the street after they've been rehabilitated and understand how to use them looks like they have 2 ordinary appendages. So the question of why they don't have a prosthesis is a totally different kind of question from why did they lose their leg in the first place. And there are circumstances in which that's the important question. The important question is, why isn't there a solution, rather than what was the initial cause? So those are the 5 problems we will, the 5 kinds of explanations we will look at and see how far we can get today. First, individual lack of concern. This is probably the most common view of America's environmental problems. Individuals simply don't care. They don't recycle because they can't be bothered. they're not sufficiently ecologically conscious. Because we are rich and energy is cheap, we use masses of energy without thinking about the depletion of the supply. Campaigns against littering are basically about this. People pollute because of inconsiderate, irresponsible behavior. Let me give you a quick little... So that's one reason why we have pollution, is people don't give a hoot. The not giving a hoot is basically an example of free riding. Let me illustrate this. Free riding is one of my favorite topics. You'll be hearing a lot about it at various times during the semester. You'll probably be sick of it by the time, you may already be sick of it, but you'll certainly get a lot of exposure to this idea of free riding. Let me just give an example with respect to recycling. How should we think about the problem of recycling from the vantage point of individual behavior and preferences? So a selfish individual would think of the problem of recycling this way. I want everyone else to recycle because it will help conserve resources. And I will benefit from that. So I'll benefit if everybody recycles because we will better manage our resources. But I'm not going to recycle because it's too much trouble. And my own wasting of resources really won't make much of a difference. Nobody's actually going to be worse off because I personally don't recycle. I'll let everybody else do it. Well, if everybody thinks that way, nobody recycles. So here's just an example. Suppose it costs you in time and effort a total of $50 a year to recycle. That's what it costs you if you do it. Suppose if everybody recycles, you will save in the long run an average $100 a year because there'll be fewer landfills, slower depletion of resources, the recycled materials will themselves be useful, and so on. So in the long run, if everybody's recycling, everybody saves $100. But it costs you $50 of time and effort a year to recycle. Now, if everyone else recycles and you don't, then your payoff is $100, right? You get the benefit, but you didn't pay the cost. If you and everyone else recycles, your payoff is $50. You get the $100 benefit, but it costs you $50 of time and effort. If you recycle and nobody else does, that is, if you are this noble recycler and you just do it because you know it's the right thing to do and you're going to do it, even if nobody else does, it's going to cost you $50 a year of time and effort, but you won't get any benefit because the $100 payoff won't be forthcoming. And if nobody recycles, it doesn't cost you anything, but you don't get any benefit. So this is your payoff matrix. Remember, that's the matrix we looked at the pre-rider problem. And if all you care about yourself, what's your preference ordering? Well, you prefer B to A, you prefer A to D, and you prefer D to C. B, A, D, C. That's your preference ordering. The individual annual cost is $50. The individual long-run benefit is $100. Everybody prefers 50 to 0. But if everybody acts as a free rider, you end up with 0 rather than 50. The solution to such a situation is pretty simple. You have mandatory recycling. If you have in the example I gave, if you simply put a tax on people, you get fined if you don't recycle, then everybody will recycle very quickly. And everybody will get the benefit. if you don't have mandatory recycling, the tendency will be, in the absence of a strong sense of community solidarity and a sense of moral commitment, the result will be minimal recycling and the benefit will be lost. Well, that's a kind of paradigm, I think, for the problem of environmental damage caused by individual behavior. Individuals not wanting to take on the cost, but still wanting to have the benefit. The second source of environmental problems comes from negative externalities. Now, negative externalities are an interesting issue with respect to the environment. Because, after all, we live in the environment itself, and so some kinds of environmental problems aren't exactly externalities because they affect us as well. The most important kind of negative externality that's centered around the environment is what can be called intergenerational negative externalities, displacing costs onto future generations by using up environmental resources or by causing environmental problems, the worst effects of which will be experienced by people in the future. Energy consumption is a really good example of this. This is a chart that's in the book. The United States has 5% of the world's population, but we consume 20% of world's energy. Fossil fuels are finite. We have 100% certainty that we will run out of them eventually. There's debate about how soon, but eventually, fossil fuels will become in very short supply. If people are selfish and make consumption and production choices only in terms of their own immediate welfare, this will lead to a depletion of resources, which is a negative externality for future generations. If all future generations were party to the decision, if their views could affect our behavior, they can't, but if they could, they would say, hey, stop consuming so much fossil fuel, so much petroleum. Leave some of it for us. They would say, it's going to cost us $50 a gallon 100 years from now. You should impose very high taxes on gas now to reduce consumption. Those high gas prices simply reflect the true cost of gas over a long enough period of time, not just the cost today, but the cost of gas in the future. Well, there's no way that you could do that. There's no market mechanism that will bring future costs to bear on current prices. Markets are very time dependent on the present. It's present costs which affect present prices, not future costs. And as a result, prices will be low and consumption will be high and the energy resource will be depleted for future generations. This slide actually belonged more in the other part. It's a consequence of our high energy consumption that our contribution to global CO2 emissions per capita are way higher than most other places in the world. When we use 20%, when 5% of the population uses 20% of global energy, it produces a huge disproportion in the per capita production of greenhouse gases. All right, that's one example of negative externality, though. A negative externality for future generations. Right? You're imposing costs not on your fellow humans today, but on future people. Another kind of negative externality is called a NIMBY. It's referred to with the expression NIMBY. NIMBY stands for not in my backyard. NIMBY externalities have to do primarily with how you locate various kinds of environmentally hazardous materials. Where do you put your toxic wastes? Where do you put your incinerators? Where do you put your landfills? And what happens is that powerful people see to it that toxic wastes and incinerators, toxic incinerators are not in their neighborhood, they're in someone else's neighborhood. This is a very big problem around the issue of radioactive waste. Nobody wants radioactive waste in their own neighborhood. They all want to displace it into some other neighborhood. And when you have conflict over where to site such things, as you can imagine, the wealthy and powerful are able to ensure that such environmentally hazardous sightings don't occur close to them. An interesting study on this issue, which focuses on specifically the question of environmental risks from toxins and how this gets structured around race, an interesting study in California, this is also discussed in the chapter of the book, looks at the racial composition of neighborhoods with the highest and lowest risks of exposure to toxins in the air, where the toxins are the result of a combination of things, where refineries are located, where landfills are located, and where toxic waste incinerators are located. And you can see from this very simple graph that the exposure to toxic wastes and toxins in the air is not random with respect to race. And that's largely the result of these NIMBY externalities, not in my backyard, results in the siting of those kinds of toxic locations close to poor neighborhoods rather than wealthy neighborhoods. Now there is a market logic to this. If you site an incinerator in a neighborhood, it lowers the property values, right? People don't want to move there. And the property values in rich neighborhoods are very high, and the property values in poor neighborhoods are low. So from a simple market logic, it makes sense to put the toxic wastes close to poor people. Precisely because they're poor, they have less economically to lose. And so the kind of shadow price, the cost, is lower. Again, that shows, I think, the way in which a market logic, the way markets allocate resources, violates other principles which we might hold, that just because you're poor you shouldn't be exposed to toxic wastes, that poverty should not be a criterion for how hazardous is the environment in which you live. Another example of this centers around the British Petroleum oil spill. Just so you get a sense of how big that spill was, this is the southern Wisconsin region, and if the oil spill had occurred in Lake Michigan, so to speak, and dumped over onto the land around us, that's the area of Wisconsin that it would have covered. The question then was, once the cleanup occurred, where were the toxic dumps located? You get all this sludge and the chemicals used to break up the oil spill were highly toxic, and they were all gathered up and then dumped somewhere. Where were they dumped? This is just a map of where the waste from the oil spill was dumped, and the percentage of people of color located within a mile of the landfills. And I won't go through this in detail, but as you can see, the biggest landfills were located in areas that had disproportionately high percentages of people of color living in the immediate neighborhood of those toxic landfills. Well, this is an example of negative externalities generated by environmental issues centering on the siting of toxic materials, where the decisions to site them are the result of a combination of the exercise of power by NIMBY movements, not in my backyard, and an economic calculation on a market logic of where the economic impact would be least harmful. Now you can see why, you know, this is a case of conflicts of values. Of course you want to cite, you want to deal with these things in a way that's least harmful economically. That makes sense. You don't want to cite a toxic waste where it's going to cause the most harm economically. But that's only one of our values. Another value is the protection of people. And this is a case where the market logic imposes costs on particular people in a way that if you didn't have a market logic, that would not be the case. The third example of negative externality I want to just discuss with you is negative externalities that come from profit-maximizing firms. We've already explored this a little. The central proposition that underlies the way profit-maximizing firms deal with the environment is, for capitalist firms, pollution is not just an accident. In general, the most profitable economic strategies will be the most polluting. That's not just happens kind of randomly. In general, the most profitable strategy is the most polluting because a polluting strategy involves displacing costs on others and therefore doesn't appear in the bottom line. This occurs in all sorts of settings. In Wisconsin, for example, there is a long-standing conflict over the use of nitrogen fertilizer in farming and how much farmers should bear the costs of preventing runoff of nitrogen fertilizer. Farmers who use nitrogen produce more at lower cost. This produces a lower price for output and lower costs for their output. They can therefore have higher profits. If farmers had to pay the full cost of cleaning up the lakes, which result from the algae blooms caused by nitrogen runoff, if those costs of cleanup were included in the price of fertilizer, then fertilizer would be way more expensive, and it wouldn't even be so obvious that the fertilizer would increase profits any longer. The ability of fertilizer to increase the profits of farmers depends in part on the ability of the fertilizer producers and farmers to displace the costs of cleaning up the results of using fertilizer, displacing them onto others. The price of fertilizer does not reflect the true costs of using fertilizer. And that's a classic negative externality. Another very important, just specific example that received a lot of attention is the example of Love Canal in New York. This is also discussed in the chapter in the book. Love Canal is a canal located near Buffalo, New York. There was a chemical factory, I believe Dow Chemical, located near Love Canal for many decades. They dumped their toxic wastes from their chemical processing into the canal because this was the profit-maximizing strategy to do so. This wasn't innocent. The decision makers knew the material was toxic. It wasn't that they were under some illusion that this was before scientific knowledge about the toxic wastes was present. They knew this stuff was toxic, but they also knew it would be much cheaper to just dump it. The result of this dumping of toxic wastes into the Love Canal was a long history of sickness, birth defects, and once it was diagnosed as being the result of the toxins, the collapse of property values. So homeowners who purchased homes in the area had their property values destroyed. Later, there was prolonged inaction by government because of the public costs for dealing with the problem and the chemical company's obstruction of the of any judicial and other public processes for imposing those costs on them. The result of this has been a long-standing battle, which is still present, although I think mostly this has been resolved by now, around the question of who pays the costs of cleaning up when the initial decision to create the mess was driven by profit maximizing. The problems get complicated because the original manufacturer of those chemicals was subsequently bought up by other firms, and the kind of historical trace of legal responsibility begins to become more confused over time. I have a video clip which I won't show because we don't have time today. I might show it at the beginning of the class next time, of an interview with residents in the Love Canal area talking about the particular process by which those toxic wastes were dumped and then the cover-up and obstruction of this in the future. In Wisconsin, as in most of the country, there is a serious problem of groundwater contamination that's the result of pesticides, herbicides, and industrial waste. There's solid research that has demonstrated that this groundwater contamination in Wisconsin causes birth defects, cancer, and other human harms. And again, in Wisconsin, just as everywhere else, the presence of these contaminants in the groundwater is the result of ordinary, mundane decisions by producers in a market economy. It is not the result of particularly nasty, you know, producers going about doing particularly nasty things. This is an ordinary thing to happen unless there is a process by which they're prevented from doing so. The only solution, really, the only effective solution to environmental pollution as negative externality by capitalist firms is to regulate it, to have laws which say you can't do this, and if you do, you'll be fined. Now, it turns out that the fines for environmental pollution are often less than the profitability of pollution. So many companies treat fines as just part of the cost of doing business. What you really need is a serious regulatory regime that would make it unprofitable for firms to pollute in this way. There are many different ways this can happen, but without that kind of strong, systematic intervention to block the profit-maximizing strategies, pollution will occur. As I mentioned in an earlier lecture, firms complain about this. They say this makes them less competitive. They complain about government regulation as obstructing their ability to make profits because in other countries, the environmental regulations might be laxer. It's up to us to decide as a result of that whether the environmental harms caused in the lives of people by allowing externalities represents a greater violation of our collectively held values than the reduction in competitiveness of particular capitalist firms as a result of being forced to pay the full costs of what they produce. The absence of environmental regulation should be thought of as a subsidy. There's a choice in regulating around the environment is not should we or should we not regulate, should we allow a free market to occur. It's really who is going to be paying the costs. And if you allow environmental pollution to occur and contamination of groundwater, what you're saying is we should all collectively subsidize the profits of these firms. We should pay the costs to them. Now, we're not paying it in the form of taxes, although when you have health effects, you are, because there are tax effects in dealing with the health consequences. But it is a subsidy. It's an illusion to say that in a private free market economy that allows environmental pollution, that the firms are not being subsidized to pollute. They are being subsidized. They are able to produce at a lower cost because we are all paying those costs to them in the form of the higher costs we face by virtue of the pollution. Well, it's 12:15. We still have two more points to go through on this lecture, so I'll finish this one and start the next one on Tuesday.